Scholars. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRabi English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned. There are fascinating points in Munajat al-Shakin, which is part of Munajat Khamsa al-Ashar by Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam. This is the Munajat of the complaints. Of course, Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam in this whisper prayer does not complain about God. His main complaints are about two things. One is about nafs or carnal soul, and another is about the Satan. In this munajat we read, O Allah, I complain to you of a soul committing to evil, rushing to offenses, eager to disobey you, and exposing itself to your anger. It takes me on the roads of disasters. It makes me the easiest of perishers before you, full of heedlessness and inattention. It hurries me to misdeeds.
خدای من پیش تو گلم رو دارم میارم از نفسی که
In these fragments of Munajat al-Shakin, Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam complains about his carnal soul, which leads him towards the evil and paves the way for committing more sins and errors. This is the carnal soul that postpones doing good and facilitates doing evil. The carnal soul, according to Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam, is after play and diversion, and establishes ignorance in a person. It is eager to disobey Allah and is never satisfied. Thank you very much, dear listeners of iRabi English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye. In the limelight.
The new U.S. Defense Department plan called Civilian Harm Mitigation and Response Action Plan, which promises killing less innocent people in wars, seems to be sanitizing the brutality of American endless wars rather than announcing these interventions illegitimate. This plan tries to humanize the American wars around the world and their consequences. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay with us, please. The website of Responsible Statecraft wrote, "A few days ago, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin announced the completion of a civilian harm mitigation and response action plan, promising institutional changes so that American war making kills fewer innocent people. The plan is a clear step forward in the humanization of endless war, the ethically fraught project attempt to spotlight in the book Humane, How the United States Abandoned Peace and Reinvented War, which appeared a year ago in a paperback edition. The Pentagon commitment and the dynamics that led to it fit well with some of arguments in the book. While making American war less brutal is an uplifting project when it works, it can also function by intentional design to create a new kind of war that results in greater legitimacy. The plan is entirely open about this. It begins, "The protection of civilians is a strategic priority as well as a moral imperative. Abetted by critical outsiders and sympathetic insiders who decry the brutality rather than existence of wars, humanizing war reflects ethical progress in the fighting of American war while entrenching its performance." According to Responsible Statecraft, historically humanitarian activists have been dramatizing civilian harm for decades, and with a special intensity since the so-called War on Terror began after September 11, 2001. But when the order to develop an action plan came down in January, it was clearly in response to the extraordinary Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporting led by Azmat Khan, which gave unprecedented visibility to the cost of American war-making on civilians by documenting the extraordinary levels of casualties in air strikes. As a New York Times editor observed, military officials credited the work of Azmat and other Times journalists who rigorously reported on this project as important factors in driving change. And it is, no doubt, quite an accomplishment to prompt that transformation. As the plan explains, reforms will bring more concern for harm to military culture and organization. Read carefully. The plan amounts for now to a set of promises to hire more people at a Pentagon and in combatant commands to raise consciousness in hopes of further remaking American war in the crucible of care. The plan will also provide a hub for information gathering about far-flung operations conducted across service branches. The military, it says, should even consider acknowledging the episodes when it causes too much death and injury. The overall goal is to mainstream ethical compassion in American military operations without disturbing the eternal and necessary project of putting civilians in harm's way. But while good might come of it, for sure, more is at stake in such mainstreaming. The plan is being called sweeping by Khan and other New York Times journalists and welcomed as a great leap forward. The Defense Department finally prioritizes civilians in conflict, one prominent targeting professional put it. Of course, there is a lot to be desired in the plan even before attempts to implement it get underway. A triumph of bureaucratic newspeak, there will be a center of excellence for civilian casualties. The document that announces it and spells out some of the details leaves lots of room for maneuver when it comes to follow through. And it does not seem to apply to the Central Intelligence Agency, which pioneered drone strikes and continues to conduct them, as in the recent killing of Al-Qaeda leader. The website of Common Dreams also wrote, perhaps most glaringly on its own terms, the plan says nothing about the international law governing the conduct of hostilities, and low essential rethinking the American interpretation of it clearly is. Indeed, the January press release announcing the reform process presents the United States as already operating in line with its legal obligations not to kill too many civilians on a strong foundation of compliance with the law of armed conflict. But questioning whether the reforms pan out or whether they someday come to guarantee even more humanity in warfare misses the bigger point, which is that the humanization of war can work to legitimate war, especially when it works. When it comes from the Pentagon, indeed, that is the point. As we narrate in Humane, the humanization of American war dates from the aftermath of the Vietnam War, precisely when the international law requiring humanitarian care in the conduct of hostilities took its own great leap forward. The American story has been driven from the first by the alliance of critical outsiders composed of activists, journalists, and lawyers with sympathetic insiders within government and military. Across a considerable divide, they bicker over how far to go in making ongoing war more humane against the background of ongoing American militarism, even as questions about whether, where, and how long war is fought are relegated to the margins. According to Common Dreams, outsiders focusing selectively on brutality and especially civilian harm join a growing constituency of insiders within the military that hope to redefine the warrior's honor while managing public relations in the face of atrocious excesses. There could hardly be better proof of how these two forces work together in producing a relatively more humanized form of ongoing war than the new plan. The results are a good thing if the choice is between relatively more brutal and relatively less brutal war, but from the perspective of old and new calls for restraint in starting wars or fighting them forever, that is not always the choice. Humanitarians are characteristically silent about the justice or legality of war itself, while journalists also generally restrict themselves to factual proof of atrocity even when it takes place in the midst of aggressive war. For example, the path-breaking New York Times series on civilian harm, which dealt substantially with the war against Daesh in Syria, nowhere took up that war is generally regarded as illegal as such under international law, quite apart from its civilian harm. So there is a risk that the new reforms will abet a dynamic described in the first 20 years of GWOT. Questions related to the justice, propriety, and legality of America's gargantuan military footprint were sidelined as the efforts were rendered a little less offensive in some of their human cost. The plan makes more of the same possible. And while Biden followed through on Trump's withdrawal from Afghanistan, he has re-engaged with the special forces in Somalia, where drones have also been deployed in operations. Overall, there may be less American war for the moment, leaving aside the forms of support for Ukraine. But it would be wishful thinking to conclude that any controls have been placed on the ongoing war posture, especially since Biden's move have come along with doubling down on Trump's confrontational position towards China. The Pentagon's promise of more humane war has to be put in that context. The controls that seem available concern how future wars are going to be fought, not whether a culture of restraint in fighting them at all ever takes root.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of Viewpoint from IRIB English Radio. In the studio with me, I have the honor of being joined by my brothers, Brother Habib and Brother Ali. Assalamu alaikum, gentlemen.
Wa alaikum
assalam wa rahmatullah.
So because the events of Ashura and the movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, note the fact that I chose the word movement, not anything else.
Thank you very much.
The movement of Imam al-Hussein and the event of Karbala is so multifaceted and it's so dynamic and it's so full of life, like 1400 years later, and people are still deriving so many messages and are developing deeper understandings of the things that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam did. I feel like because of that, there's still a lot of concepts therein that we need to clarify, right? All right, so there's two questions that I have here. Number one, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam rose to establish justice, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's understandable because it was his responsibility as divine leader, right, to establish justice. And the question, however, I have is that he set off, he got killed. What justice was established?
Mm-hmm.
What rights did he gain for anyone, anywhere? I mean, even after
can I
that,
to a question and
the Ahl al-Bayt were under even more pressure.
Yeah. Medina was attacked by Yazid.
Exactly,
after the death
and
of
the Kaaba was burned down.
The Kaaba was burned down. People still, they're saying that's available. وَارْتَدَّ النَّاسِ عَنْ الدِّينِ إِلَّا ثَلَاثَ بَعْدَ مَقْتَلِ الْحُسَيْنِ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ. And then they state the three companions of Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam. So where was the justice?
By killing a person and thinking that you have put up everything and you have actually closed it down and nothing comes up. So it's wrong understanding.
Are you saying that it had long-term effects?
So this blood, actually, this is the blood that is flourishing, that it comes up and actually this gives life to the Islamic Ummah.
Through generations.
Yeah. What is Yazid now and what is Hussein? What is the status of Yazid in Islamic Ummah? So, let me tell you some quotes from Islamic scholars about Yazid.
Before that, can I just bring up this quote of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam that pretty much answers your question? Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, when he entered Medina after Karbala, people were sending their condolences and telling him "Azam Allah ajrak," and they were praying for him, trying to
console him.
Yeah, console him and whatnot. A man came who was happy with what happened to Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, who said, "Who won?" He asked him, "Who won?" Imam Sajjad alayhi salam replied, "When the adhan comes up, you will know who won." This is a very deep statement. And of course, I don't say it's the reason of Mu'mvat of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, but I say that it's one of the benefits that happened because of the killing of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, that the religion remained, that Yazid has no power to do with Muawiyah what Muawiyah did, that propaganda that Muawiyah had, which was pretty much to wear the dress of Islam and state that we are Islam, we are the representative of Islam. Yazid has no power to do that anymore because of the movement of Imam Hussein.
By killing Imam al-Hussein, Yazid dug his own grave.
Yeah, look, Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani, in his book Al-Sawa'iq, he narrates from Imam Ahmad Hanbal, that is the leader of the Hanbalis.
Yes.
That when he was asked, are we allowed to curse Yazid? I said, whom should we curse if we do not curse Yazid? Imam of Hanabala, right? Allama taftazani Hanafi. Again, in his book, Sharh al-Aqa'id.
Sharh al-Maqasid or Sharh al-Aqa'id?
Sharh al-Aqa'id. He says that, again, when Yazid killed the family and the household of the Prophet and actually insulted them, and it is frequently narrated what about the news and the akhbar that happened there, and we all agree about his disbelief.
His kufr.
His blatant blasphemy.
Let me not talk about Imam Shawkani. Let me not say what, let's say, Ibn Khaldun said. Let me not tell you what Ibn Jawzi al-Hanbali said. So this is the Yazid in today's life and Hussein.
So just long-term effects. We're talking about long-term effects.
No, even in the short term. Even in the short term, right. Look, those who missed the time and did not accompany Hussein and stood in front of him, exactly a minute after his martyrdom, started their grief and their sorrow.
People of Kufa when the
not only from Shias of Iraq, different groups of Islamic Ummah at that time. Right after the martyrdom of Hussein, they understood what a big mistake they did.
Inside of Sham, when Imam Zain al-Abidin,
that's why one of the lessons that we take from the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, we have to understand what time we are in. We have to learn about the moments. Look, these moments are very critical. Sometimes it's very short and we have to make a big decision. So this is the lesson that we have to take. Where are we now standing? Are we with Hussein of the time or in front of Hussein of the time? So this is what we have to learn.
There are a couple of things that can I add, please? I want to just add two things. My brother beautifully put it out there that if we believe that the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam was a revolt, a revolution, to bring up justice, and
but you don't
that
believe
the base,
that, though. You don't like calling
it
an uprising.
That the concept of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the basis of the takfiris is not the same as the base of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. The true divine bases that are available. Yani even the Shias, when they come to talk about the factor of rising, all of them agree that there has to be the idhn, the permission of the Imam or Na'ibi, the authority after the Imam. And anyhow, there's also a different answer to what the brother stated that's also available out there. And I always like to introduce it. It's very important for me, I feel, that the fact that Imam Hussein alayhi salam, who said that he was revolting? And
you always press on that.
Yes. And the fact is that the only thing that Imam Hussein alayhi salam did was not do bay'ah to Yazid. Abdullah ibn Zubayr also didn't do bay'ah to Yazid.
Yes, dear Sheikh, look, this is true. I agree with you, but look, just a moment, in parentheses. Look, these men are showing a disagreement by revolt, by uprising, by whatever you want to call it.
It was a rebellion.
There's this thing in the middle. There's this gray area.
We are not fighting on the terms and the words.
There's this gray area of staying quiet. The thing that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam did. The thing that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam did. The thing that Imam al-Askar alayhi salam did. This is staying quiet. I'm not against you. I'm not with you. I'm not doing anything. Just leave me alone. This concept of just leave me alone. So there are three choices that the Imam alayhi salam had: fight against him, agree with him, or sit down. Fight against him, you need an army. The people of Kufa, Imam Hussein, it's a long topic, I know, but in summary, simple people knew that Kufa was against, were betrayers. From the time of Amir Mu'min to Imam Hussein. So how about Imam Hussein with his wisdom? Even if we take them like an ordinary smart person. There's this, I don't have the right army. I don't have the right people. Or at least, when I reached to Kufa, before Kufa, there was no chance of going back. The way that he, and agreeing with Yazid is against Islam. Because if I agree with Yazid now, Islam would demolish. So there's this concept of staying quiet, like how Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam did with the bay'ah of As-Saqifah. And وَكَانَ اللَّهُ يُحِبُّ الْمُحْسِنِينَ, it would have went through. But Yazid, no, wanted the head of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. He wanted to kill him. Send me with this message, this reply to Walid ibn Aqma, with this message, the head of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein exited Medina. When he exited Medina, he went to Mecca, the safest place on earth. In the safest place of earth, Yazid sent Al-Asraj, who was put in place of Al-Walid ibn Aqba, to Mecca to kill Imam Hussein alayhi salam, to assassinate him, even if he was متعلق بأستار الكعبة. So he left Mecca.
What does that mean?
If he was attached to the Kaaba.
Mm.
He was seeking refuge to the Kaaba. Even if he was in that status, they wanted to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
So he left because he was afraid, he was going to get killed. And he doesn't want to get killed. Look at his words. He says, "An uqtul shubran an Mecca." To be killed, one... Shubr. What is shubr?
A few inches away.
A few inches off Mecca is better than to be killed in Mecca. إني أخاف أن أكون الكبش الذي قال عنه رسول الله. رسول الله was talking about Abdullah ibn Zubayr. I am afraid to be the cattle that would be slaughtered inside of Mecca. And therefore, when he went to Kufa, it was the safe place for him. Basra, people were against him because of the war of Basra. They were against his health. He wanted to go to Yemen. It was far off. The best place to go was Kufa. Why? Because people were calling that, we will defend you. We will help you. We are calling for you. We are against Yazid.
Yeah.
So it was a place to be, to defend at least.
And then?
And then the betrayal happened with Muslim ibn Aqil. He rushed to Wadi al-Aqiq, if I'm not wrong, or al-Tan'im. I forgot the place. The army of Hur came. They wanted to take him as a prisoner. He told them, let me go.
Let me go back.
Let me go back. Let me go Yemen. Let me go Hind. They said, no. You will come under the government of...
So basically, Imam al-Hussein was minding his own business.
Yes.
Yazid kept pushing and pushing and pushing.
Yes.
Yazid was either, he was like, either pledge your allegiance to me or I'm going to kill you.
Yes.
And Imam al-Hussein tried to avoid it and avoid it and avoid it. And he was like, let me go to Kufa. They're calling for me. He went. They stopped him anyway. And they were still like, we're going to kill you.
Yeah. And then they took him to Karbala.
Where do you want to go?
And then he reaches Karbala. Again, another thing to also keep in mind to consider. The Imam alayhum as-salam, when they say cry, does this crying have a mawdu'iyya, that it's by itself a subject or that is recommended?
Mm.
Or like how, for example, Sayyid Musa al-Sadr states that Imam Hussein alayhi as-salam or the Ahl Bayt do not care about the crying part. The crying part is a path for you to do this and that and this and that and to wake up and to understand. And they call it the teachings of Karbala.
Mm.
There's a big difference between the two.
The respected Sheikh, Brother Habib, says that Imam Hussein alayhi salam did not make an uprising or a revolution, whatever we can call it, what we mean by the word inqilab. I want to say no, it was really an uprising against the tyrant regime of the time. So there are lots of evidences that helps us to see what was the goal and the objective of Imam from this movement. Let's study Imam from the very beginning. Imam, what does he say in his words? He says that I have left to make reforms in the Ummah of the Holy Prophet, in the nation of my grandfather, the Holy Prophet, and to do Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahi al Munkar, to actually ask people to perform, to enjoin the good and refrain from the evil. So let's talk about these two phrases that Imam alayhi salam himself said. So to follow exactly what happened at that time, which was against the nation, against the sunnah of the Holy Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So it means that there was a great distortion. Second, Imam says, Amrun bin Ma'ruf, enjoining the good. As for Amrun bin Ma'ruf and Nahi anil Munkar, it is quite famous that they have three stages. The first stage of Amrun bin Ma'ruf, that is enjoining the good, is the stage of doing it by heart. Second stage is to perform and do it by tongue. The third stage is the practical level of Amr bin Ma'ruf. The same goes for Amr Nahi Anil Munkar. So what is the greatest Amr in an Islamic Ummah? Establishment or Iqamah, whatever we have titled it, whatever we have named it as Iqamah of Hukumatul Adl. What has been defined as the mission of all the prophets, all the divine prophets of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and the scene of the earth. So all of them have come, based on what Allah says in Quran, to establish Iqamah, or to do and to create a just government. So this is the highest level of amr, the practical way of it. So Imam, as the leader of the Islamic Ummah, has had to do something for that. Again, let's see the opposite side. What is the highest level of munkar? The highest level of munkar, the evil, is the tyrant government, the distorted government of the time. So it's the duty of Imam and the leaders of the Islamic Ummah, or even the followers, to perform all those three stages. So Imam, even at the time of Muawiyah, he showed his hatred of the governing system of Muawiyah by sending him some letters. You might say that, okay, why Imam was silent at that time? No, Imam was not even silent at that time. He sent the letters. He warned him with the mistakes that he had in his rulership and government. He told him this. These points are the points that you have deviated from the true and genuine Muhammadan Islam. And again, he showed his hatred. Second, he wrote a letter. But what happened to the functional action, to functional level of it? So it was due to the duty of Imam, because Imam is not a person who breaks the treaties. Imam, through the treaties that actually was written and signed between Muawiyah and Imam Hassan alayhi salam, he was still under the treaty. So he could not actually emerge and get out of that treaty. So you might say, okay, Muawiyah before that, somewhere in the masjid said, okay, I'm not following this treaty anymore. Yes, but Muawiyah used politics to say that. He came and said that, he in the masjid, he said that, okay, there are some other commitments which are not in this treaty, and I'm leaving those treaties. I'm leaving them out. So it means that politically he was going to actually fool people that, okay, this is, I'm not directly actually breaking the treaty. So it was, in case Imam wanted to break the treaty, he was known as the person who actually broke the promise that was given earlier. So Imam did everything. I mean, Imam did all the levels and stages of Amr bin Ma'ruf. When it comes to the An-Nahi Anil Munkar, so the highest level of Munkar, as I said, is the government of deviation, the government of distortion, the government of Yazid. That Imam said, a person like me is never ever allowed to actually pay allegiance with a person like Yazid. Everyone knew who Yazid was at that time. So Imam actually wanted to do so. At this time, he's not under any treaty anymore. So he leaves Medina, he goes towards Mecca. Because Yazid sent Walid ibn Utbah to take allegiance from Imam alayhi salam in Medina. But Imam left Medina in order to not respond him, not to reply him, and leaves for a city that he can find a media for himself. Yes, in Mecca there is a place that Hajjaj and the Hajjis come every year. And at that time, at that place, he could even send the message of Islam and the message of true Muhammad Islam to the Hajjaj from different nations. Again, Yazid sent a troop to kill Imam in Mecca. So what was Imam's actually innovation here? Imam doesn't want the land of security, Madinatul Amn of Mecca, to be changed into a Medina of actually shedding the blood of the people. So what does Imam do? Imam says that I don't want my blood to be covered in the land of Mecca. He looks for another way. At this time, we have seen that letters are flooding from Kufa, that Muslims from Kufa invite him to come and actually take the leadership. Okay, Imam, as the leader of the Islamic Ummah, what is his duty? Is to answer the letters, to reply to the letters. When it is the duty of him, even though he knew what would be the outcome and consequence of that, Imam replies to the letter and he sends Muslim al-Aqil to Kufa. Okay, then what happens? The brother said that, okay, even Imam in the middle of the way said, okay, you are not going to accept me anymore, I'll go back. No, brother, it's not true. Imam, even at the beginning of the way, he understood that Muslim was got martyred. So in case at that time, even Imam could live, could go back to another city or to Medina or to anywhere else. No, Imam knew purposely. Imam knew that he had started a reform movement, what we call it, a revolution, an uprising against the tyrant ruler of the time. So he continues to go. Yes. When Imam says such a thing, based on what the brother says, it's due to the duty of a Muslim, a leader of the Ummah, that he never starts a war, what we call it, primitive war, or Jihad al-Ibtida'i, So Imam does not, like the Holy Prophet, does not want to start any war. But at the time that defense is becomes compulsory, no, Imam is not somebody who leaves the battlefield. He stands in the battlefield till he is martyred. So this is the philosophy behind the story of Ashura and Karbala.
This will also open the doors for you to make assumptions about Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, especially those who claim, like Sayyid al-Khu.
I'm very glad.
From his explanation, I can make it also a good conclusion that even while the Majah in Iraq says that, okay, stay at home, then do not
that's why
make
the
chaos. But this is very good to know that religion and states are interrelated.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Religion and state.
Yes,
I mean, Dina Siyasa, they are not in, disrelated.
We had Madina al-Hub, now we're saying Madina al-Siyasa.
This is a really rational point that we are, I mean, after 40 years in Islamic Republic, we are saying and want to tell the Islamic Ummah, religion is intermingled with the states, and
it
we
is.
Have to know
it
that
is.
The Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, at the same time that he was an Islamic leader, at the same time he was a political leader of the Medina. And he was the leader,
yes.
And let's say, whatever we can call it, in Medina, he was the person who made this city-state in Arabian Peninsula.
When you look at the Islamic laws, there cannot be religion with a state without religion.
Very true.
Al-Hudud, the capital punishments, the diyas, al-Hakim al-Shar'i, Baytul Mal, if we accept that there's this. Inheritance. Not only that, Imam Salat al-Jum'ah, al-Qadhi,
the judges. Right.
All of these have to do with religion, path of life. Religion
is
inseparable from
state. I'm very
states.
Glad that we opened this door because finally Brother Habib got to defend his stance. And we all came to this conclusion that we were saying the same thing from the very beginning. We always
There's
do that.
There's a difference
that.
To it. There's a difference
but
to
there
it.
Are key points that everyone stresses on when in expressing their opinions. And I like that. I respect that too because it brings us to such a deeper understanding of Ashura, and that's the point of such discussions. Inshallah ta'ala, if there are any other points that you guys want to continue, we can pick it up in further episodes of this show. Thank you so very much for being with us. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Allahumma ja'al mahya ya mahya Muhammad wa ala Muhammad ومماتي ممات محمد وآل محمد To Allah, you have shown us so much courage through the pain. You sacrificed your family and were guilt-thirsty, oh Hussein.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
American intervention in Latin America began in 1823 when President James Monroe declared the continent to be a U.S. sphere of influence. Under the Monroe Doctrine, Washington claimed the right to intervene militarily across Latin America. That led to the Banana Wars, in which the U.S. military fought to reassert American power and monopoly of plantations in Central America, Mexico, and the Caribbean. Washington has so far orchestrated and supported many coups across Latin America that have been characterized as U.S. foreign policy in the region since the early 20th century. Throughout history, there's been a lot of U.S. meddling in Latin America, especially in Central America. U.S. foreign policy towards Central America heightened during the Cold War and the spread of the leftist movements and revolutions. Many believe that the success of the Cuban Revolution in the 1950s made the U.S. nervous to think that there could be political superpowers like the USSR at the time, leading them in getting involved in what they perceived as their backyard. All this set the stage for a sustained and violent U.S. intervention across Central America, backing vicious local allies in wars that claimed thousands of lives and displaced millions. The latest U.S. attempts of intervening in Latin America in its long list of interventions is considered as what it calls funding for democracy promotion in Cuba. Havana has, however, slammed the move, saying it's illegal and aimed at toppling the government. Let's not forget the USAID program in Cuba. As it was reported at the time, the U.S. secretly created Cuban Twitter to stir unrest and undermine the government of President at the time, Fidel Castro. It started a social network built on texts in hope that it could be used to organize smart mobs to trigger a Cuban spring. The island nation, which is currently facing its worst economic crisis in decades amid U.S. sanctions, announced electricity blackouts this month. Along with soaring food, fuel, and medicine prices as shortage grips, people are observing long queues for necessities. The U.S. trade embargo, which has been in place against Cuba since 1962, was reinforced under former President Donald Trump. Meanwhile, Trump's successor has also chosen to follow the same path. U.S. intervention has gone far enough that some Congress lawmakers have even advocated for bombing strikes.
We can go back to 1960, in fact, and the Mallory Rubottom memo, it's a State Department memo, that lays out the scenario that Cuba is experiencing today. It says that as secretly as the wording is actually as inconspicuously as possible to disrupt the livelihoods, the employment, the income of the Cuban people. So this has been a policy ever, you know, since 1960, April 6, 1960. The other part of that is that they intend to press the people into rebellion against the government. So clearly, regime change is part of the program.
Venezuela plunged into political turmoil after the U.S.-sponsored opposition figure Juan Guaido launched a botched coup to oust democratically elected President Nicolas Maduro. The attempted coup, which came with the green light off and support of Washington, is yet another example of Washington's intentions with Latin America. The U.S. has even imposed several rounds of sanctions against Venezuela aimed at ousting Maduro and replacing him with Guaido. The sanctions, which include the illegal confiscation of Venezuelan assets abroad and an economic blockade, have caused poverty, a lack of access to basic goods, gasoline shortages, and power cuts. But despite all this, the U.S. seems to have failed in its foreign policy regarding not only Venezuela, but Latin America as a whole, where most of the recently elected presidents have already expressed their ambitions of distancing themselves from the U.S. and establishing stronger ties among themselves.
And, you know, you're not asking this, but there is a new international realignment, and partly I think it's because of these blockades, because of the unilateral action by the United States against countries that are developing. to impose its own financial rule on the on other countries. We need, the United States needs to learn that other countries have a right to determine their own form of government, that their own way of living, that the people in those countries have that right without the United States putting them into debt, without sanctioning them, without creating hardships, and without military attack.
The latest turn of events is also an indication of the U.S.'s failed sanctions policy. Venezuela has, despite the sanctions, managed to double its oil production recently thanks to Iran's help. Iran itself, which is also heavily sanctioned by Washington, is also a prime example of the U.S.'s failed policies, as it has managed to withstand the economic pressure while gradually finding ways around them.
The G7 countries have agreed to implement a price cap on Russian imports, despite warnings from the Kremlin to halt sales to countries imposing the restriction. Finance ministers of the United States, Japan, Canada, Germany, France, Italy, and the United Kingdom agreed on a plan to ban the provisions of services that enable maritime transportation of Russian-origin crude oil and petroleum products globally. This means importers seeking shipping services and insurance cover from companies based in G7 and EU countries would need to adhere to a price cap to transport Russian oil. The level of the cap is still being discussed. The German finance minister has stated the purpose of the move as such.
We want to limit Russia's revenues and at the same time reduce economic damage to our societies. This price cap on Russian oil exports is designed to reduce Putin's revenues.
The cap is expected to take effect at the same time as the next EU embargoes on Russian oil in early December. Moscow has warned that it will retaliate by banning oil exports to countries that implement the restriction. The Kremlin has warned that a price ceiling will significantly destabilize the oil markets, resulting in scarcity in global oil markets and soaring prices for European consumers. The ban is part of a range of measures taken by the West targeting Russia for the war in Ukraine. In response to the war, the U.S. decided to prohibit the import of oil, refined petroleum products, natural gas, and coal from Russia. These restrictions on Russian energy imports have contributed to higher gas prices and increased inflation pressure across the U.S. Washington's European allies are in no better condition. The European countries have plunged into a devastating energy crisis. Consumers are facing huge bills and the highest rates of inflation since the 1980s. Shell's chief executive officer has earlier warned that gas shortages could persist for several years, raising the prospect of continued energy rationing. Russian energy giant Gazprom has halted flows via the crucial Nord Stream 1 pipeline to Europe. The company cited an oil leak and didn't give a timeline of when the shipments might resume. This comes in the wake of the G7 countries' decision to impose a price cap on Russian oil. The continued shutdown of the pipeline could exacerbate the energy crisis in Europe, as it is the biggest pipeline for gas from Russia, accounting for about 35% of Europe's total Russian gas imports last year. Russia had already threatened to retaliate by banning oil exports to countries that implement a price cap. Since June, Gazprom has slashed flows through Nord Stream 1 to just 20% of its capacity, citing maintenance issues as a dispute over a missing turbine caught up in Western export sanctions. It has also cut off supplies to several unfriendly European countries and energy companies over their refusal to pay for gas in rubles. The West has already sanctioned many Russian energy exports, but Moscow has continued to earn billions of dollars a month by diverting oil to countries such as China and India. China's crude imports from Russia soared to a record level in May, ousting Saudi Arabia as the country's top supplier.
The prices that are being paid for Russian oil are far higher than the cost of actually extracting that oil. So what the Russians are taking advantage, in other words, of the situation they're imposing by their boycotts and by the war in Ukraine.
The West is trying to sever the Kremlin's revenues by imposing a ceiling for Russian exports, But Moscow has proved that it can reduce the exporting of its products to Europe and still have mass revenues. Iran Central Bank says Tehran and Moscow have officially started doing business in their national currencies, adding both countries are considering de-dollarizing other parts of their economic ties. Tehran and Moscow had long been seeking to create a mechanism to replace the US dollar with their national currencies, rial and ruble, as part of a joint de-dollarization agenda, regardless of the tough economic sanctions in place against the two nations. Iran and Russia have both been subjected to tough economic sanctions by Western countries and are determined to deepen their economic cooperation, adding that there are great capacities for increasing the volume of bilateral trade. Several officials in Tehran and Moscow have repeatedly accused the United States of using the dollar as an instrument to wage economic and political war. China is another economic and political power that has opted to move toward de-dollarization. In fact, Iran, Russia, and China have discussed the de-dollarization of their trade for decades and have considered launching an alternative for the worldwide interbank financial telecommunication global network, or SWIFT. Following the breakout of the Russia-Ukraine conflict early this year, U.S.-led Western governments imposed several rounds of financial sanctions on Moscow, including freezing its foreign exchange reserves. The thought that the U.S. may move to confiscate one's assets in case they refuse to accept what Washington dictates has caused more countries to consider diversifying their reserve assets away from U.S. dollar. Consequently, many countries have turned away from European democracies and Washington. Regardless of who wins the Ukraine war, the United States and its allies will be the strategic losers. Russia will probably build closer relations with China and other countries on the Eurasian continent, including India, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the Persian Gulf Arab countries.
We are seeing a deepening of ties unlike any other time that we've seen before. And ultimately, what this means is that the relationship between Russia and China is no longer being governed by the same economic rules that had governed it prior to this year. That is that Russian rubles are being traded. They're no longer doing business in dollars. And ultimately, that is hurting the United States. And it's going to change the dollar's hegemony.
In recent years, with the increased weaponization of the dollar and Washington's use of the dollar to sanction the so-called unruly countries in America's eyes, many countries in the world have awakened and begun to experiment trading in their own national currencies. Since the U.S. has been using the dollar and sanctions as a weapon to hurt other economies, its competitors have no obligation to help the U.S. maintain the dollar hegemony. The dollar's decades-long dominance has placed America in a strong position to dictate the terms of global trade and finance for the last 70 years. But this time, Russia wants to do something different, as Moscow is determined to launch a counter-offensive against Western sanctions and the dollar-centric global financial system. Following the unprecedented Western financial and economic sanctions, Moscow asked all unfriendly countries that are imposing sanctions on it to pay for their fuel purchases in Russia's rubles. The measure immediately helped stabilize the value of the ruble and significantly diffused the negative impact of Western sanctions. In addition to crude oil and natural gas, some economists have suggested Moscow extend the requirement for importers of Russia's grain, chemical fertilizers, and other products to transact in rubles instead of dollars or euros.
I think what we're witnessing now is the birth of a multipolar world order. And what that means ultimately is that after the collapse of the Soviet Union in the late 80s and early 90s, the United States became the single hegemonic global power. And what we are seeing now is that the United States, after two decades of brutal wars in the Middle East, in North Africa, of the rampant imperialist expansion and regime change policies and nation-building policies of the U.S. regime, that now Russia, China, Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, South Africa, many countries are coming together and saying no more to U.S. Expansionism.
Russia and China certainly are engaged in a bid to change the U.S. rules-based order, but instead of trying to replace one hegemony, that is the dollar, with another, they are encouraging the rest of the world to assert their autonomy and independence.
Rising costs in the U.S. have pushed Americans to the edge with soaring inflation and the government's inability to control the matter so far. Inflation in the U.S. has shattered all previous records in March and currently is hovering around 8.5%. With inflation hitting the highest rate since 1981, the rising cost of living has been squeezing households and putting pressure on policymakers to bring the issue under control. And now government officials have warned Americans that the worst is yet to come. The U.S. Federal Reserve's Chair Jerome Powell has warned of pain ahead for Americans in the battle against inflation. While pledging that the Fed will continue to act forcefully, he also warned that the U.S. job market will suffer in order to get prices down. He says the damage which will be dealt to the job market is an unfortunate cost of reducing inflation.
Well, you know, monetary policy only has an effect of 6 to 9 months of a lag. He just started raising interest rates here significantly in the last 2 months. So it won't really start to have an impact on inflation here until fourth quarter, maybe, of this year. But it won't have that much impact, I don't believe. I don't believe that it's going to be very quickly reducing inflation from its current 8.5% down to the Federal Reserve's 2% target here within the next 6 months or even within the next 18 months. I don't think they're going to get it down to that. They're going to continue raising rates because the only real solution, even if it is a limited solution, is monetary policy interest rates. They aren't going to hike taxes to slow down the economy. Government spending is just shifting from social program spending to military spending and subsidies to corporations kind of spending. So fiscal policy isn't going to do anything. Monetary policy can only have a limited effect, but the Fed is going to push that solution as high and as long as it can to shake out whatever it can shake out in terms of inflation.
According to recent surveys, Americans believe inflation tops the list of problems the country is faced with. This has led to U.S. President Joe Biden's approval ratings plunging heavily, leaving the Republicans criticizing him over the issue. Nevertheless, the U.S. government seems to be more concerned about the conflict in Ukraine, where it has so far given away billions of dollars in weaponry. The price of gasoline in the U.S. has witnessed a record high, averaging more than $5 a gallon in recent weeks for the first time ever. Meanwhile, Biden's attempts of lowering prices, which have included draconian measures like releasing crucial gasoline emergency reserves and even begging the Saudis to increase their oil output, have so far proven to be ineffective. While Americans are suffering and getting crushed under the dire economic situation, the government headed by Biden has just pledged another $3 billion U.S. dollars in aid to Ukraine. Washington has already assisted Ukraine with more than $18 billion in military aid since the launch of the Russian special military operation. But why is it that while Biden has described combating inflation as his top domestic priority, the government can't think about its own citizens before spending money on these wars?
This is only the beginning of subsidizing Ukraine. It's like 60 to 70 billion already in just 6 months. Ukraine says it needs 7 billion a month just to keep its economy going. Treasury Secretary Yellen of the U.S. Said, we're going to give you $4 billion. So the U.S. is propping up Ukraine economically and militarily and so forth. It's become an economic satrapy of the United States. The U.S. is deeply penetrated economically in Ukraine. That's why it won't leave. And that's why, you know, it provoked this situation with this war purposely. The U.S. Really sees it's got, its 2 feet on the ground there in Ukraine. And its whole policy with regard to this war is just to continue the war in a low grade, well, maybe not so even low grade, for as long as necessary.